The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It is true that the people doing the work, you know, may come from visual arts backgrounds, or they may come from filmmaking, and, you know, their entire education was around aesthetic questions. So I don't think you can remove that completely from the equation. But I think for us, it's remaining absolutely clear on the destination being the courtroom, and in the service of addressing the facts of the case in that context.
I'm Tyler McBrien, managing editor of Lawfare. And this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 1st, 2023. In last month's landmark settlement, the city of New York agreed to pay over $13 million to a group of 1,380 protesters who were arrested and are subjected to force by NYPD officers in Manhattan and Brooklyn in the summer of 2020. The proposed settlement marks the largest total payout to protesters in a class action suit in the United States, according to Akella Lacey at The Intercept. The plaintiffs won the case, at least in part, thanks to the work of Situ Research, a group that conducts visual investigations and, quote, merges data and design to create new pathways for justice, according to their website. Situ Research's work supports activists, advocates, and lawyers, bridging the gap between digital evidence and the communities that can best deploy them towards justice and accountability. I sat down with Brad Samuels, a founding partner at Situ, who has overseen the team's visual investigations for legal and advocacy organizations, including the International Criminal Court, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the United Nations, and many others. We discussed why forensic reconstructions and other visual investigations are so useful in the pursuit of justice for war crimes and other abuses, how Samuels and his colleagues build them, and some of the pushback they get. We also talked about the thorny new questions these new technologies raise, including the dangers of re-traumatizing victims. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 1st, bringing digital evidence into the courtroom. So, Brad, I want to start with a bit of a scene-setting question. I would love if you could first just describe what Situ Research is, what you do there, and if you could break down some of these terms that are used in this world for our listeners. You know, what is a visual investigation, for example? What is a forensic recreation? If you could just give us a lay of the land to start us off.
Sure. Well, we describe Situ Research's practice as merging data and design to create new pathways for justice. I would say that we sort of occupy the spaces between law, advocacy, and journalism. But whether we're working in, you know, any of those domains, the kind of through line is that we're trying to innovate around new methods and tools and techniques for fact-finding and reporting, usually in relation to human rights violations. In terms of visual investigations, this is I would say it's a nascent field, which maybe is like in its adolescent period, perhaps. It's becoming more mature, but it was more speculative, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago. It generally describes a type of investigation which leverages a whole range of different types of media and assets. And it's nominally visual, but it also could include audio and other types of data formats as well. But the idea is to really kind of, if we can say that textual reporting has long been the norm for how we communicate findings, visual investigations is a good effort to synthesize different types of video, diagrams, 3D models, geospatial information, all together to kind of produce a report kind of greater than the sum of its parts. We found that, you know, reporting was often done textually and things that were being described were often visual or spatial in nature. And it just made much more sense to us to use the native formats to come to some of the same thing, you know, findings, and also to open up new questions. And it's a sort of, because it's an emerging field, it's been helpful to have, you know, a term emerge that we can all kind of, different institutions, different organizations can coalesce around in terms of what we do. A reconstruction or forensic reconstruction is simply an effort to sort of create a coherent and clear account, usually of a contested event. So the reconstruction could be in 3D, three dimensions. It could be in two dimensions. It could be about becoming very clear on a sequence of events, which are only captured in audio. But generally speaking, regardless of the format that it takes, it's an effort to be as precise as possible about what we know in terms of understanding an event, which may have, you know, different narratives and different sort of noise, let's say, around it. And so there's all different types of tools and methods that can be leveraged to try and address that question.
Yeah, and I'd love to make this tangible or real for the listeners. So I know C2 Research has been involved in a number of really fascinating cases and investigations, but maybe if we could take one of the more recent headline-grabbing investigations, and that was the recent quite large NYPD payout to protesters who sustained police abuses, especially in the 2020 protest after the murder of George Floyd. Could you walk me through a bit about the history of that summer, of the investigations you were taking part in, how you recreated that for a courtroom, you know, what kind of inputs, basically how you took on such a sprawling investigation like that?
Sure. Yeah, I'd say, you know, like many other investigations that we've been working on specifically around suppression of dissent or protests in urban areas, there is almost a deluge of video. It seems like with each new case, there's more and more and more video, more data to structure, more videos to watch, and to the point where it almost becomes prohibitively time consuming to even, you know, organize the information, let alone trying to find something that's relevant to an investigative priority. And that was definitely the case with the George Floyd protests and all over the US, and certainly in New York, there was a tremendous amount of video documentation. The first sort of point of entry for us was analyzing video in a project with Human Rights Watch, which we did together on something called a kettle, which is a tactic that was, you know, employed by the NYPD to encircle protesters and basically trap them, limiting their ability to escape. And then in this particular case that we looked at in the Bronx, conduct mass arrests, basically. And the reason why the reconstruction was important in that case was because there's no shortage of video. There's a lot of video, but it's, you know, handheld phones. It's very shaky. It's a very sort of violent situation, and you don't get the full context in any one piece of video, but there's multiple videos that capture the same moments in time. And so the project was really about, first, syncing up video footage that are capturing the same moment from different vantage points. So might be on one side of the, you know, outside of the police kettle, someone's taking video. Within the police kettle, someone's taking a different video. From an upper floor of an adjacent apartment building, someone's looking down and taking another video, and so on. And by syncing the video footage, you can start to get a better picture of what happened. And I think in that case, you know, there was assertions being made by the mayor and the chief of police the following day that the protesters were violent and that they had only enforced the kettle after curfew. It turns out neither of those were true. And that was only became apparent when taking a hard look at all, not one piece of footage, but all of it together. And then the last thing I'll say about that is kettling is a tactic which is used to sort of prevent egress or prevent exit, but it can't really be understood abstractly. It needs to be looked at in relation to the built environment, the city. So in that case, the NYPD had waited very strategically till protesters had gotten to a certain point along a street. and then enforce the kettle at the end of the road. So police in the front, police in the back, but there were buildings on either side. So it wasn't just the kind of law enforcement themselves encircling the police. It was a combination of law enforcement tactic with the built environment together. And that's where the 3D model really helps you gain that perspective. So that was the first case we worked on in terms of the BLM protests in New York City. But we subsequently sort of applied that same strategy to class action lawsuit that was brought on behalf of protesters for every other protest that occurred during that same period of time, May 28th to like June 4th in 2020. So if there was like 800 videos for the Mott Haven case, that went up to like 6,300 videos for the entire city. And a slightly different investigative question, which was, because it was about a class action lawsuit, can we demonstrate that there was widespread and systemic misconduct? And so we were looking at not just one case, but different types of misconduct as they appear in different parts of the city over many different days. And that was a tremendous amount of video to go through and posed its own challenges, but was very useful ultimately in sort of demonstrating the investigative priorities of the lawsuit, which ultimately was settled and did not go to court.
I want to sit with that challenge for just a bit. How do you sort through this vast amount of evidence, not only piecing together the sequence of events? I imagine a lot of the videos come without metadata. And so, you know, geolocating it, placing it on a timeline, verifying that, you know, these are real videos from victims or demonstrators. How do you tackle such an immense challenge?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Well, I will maybe start at the end and say that we only got, you know, a very small fraction of the way through the 6,300. It takes a lot of time. And it's an interesting time to be kind of reflecting on this with the introduction of massive leaps in, you know, machine learning and computer vision over the past few months, because I think it's going to change and become a more efficient process in the near future. But for now, the first step is to try and determine where and when a video was taken. And sometimes you have metadata, sometimes you don't. But even when you do, the metadata is never authoritative. You know, the metadata can be wrong. So that at best is a kind of starting point. It also depends on the context in which you're working. You know, we've been doing a lot of work on suppression of dissent in other parts of the world, you know, in Ukraine and Nicaragua and Iraq before 2020, and then pivoted very hard after the murder of George Floyd to focus our efforts domestically. Because we are doing the work in New York and we're based in New York, we know the city very well. And so the geolocation becomes a lot more straightforward. Doing work somewhere very far away from where we live is a whole different matter and requires very close collaboration with partners on the ground. But in the case of New York City, it's time consuming, but, you know, it was pretty clear where footage was taken. And then, you know, the question of where and when, and in terms of the protests, there were different protests happening on different days in different parts of the city. And so those two things build on each other. And the goal is to get as much chronolocated, or, you know, figuring out when, as geolocated or where. In one of the interesting things that did happen with the class action lawsuit in New York City for the BLM protests was that we got a lot of body cam footage. And the body cam footage, we had aerial surveillance footage that was all gathered during the discovery process. That all had timestamps on it. Again, not to be sort of authoritative, it needs to be kind of corroborated in other means, but it's a good place to start. And so we did develop a kind of tool or a kind of a script to scrape all of the timestamps and begin to populate a spreadsheet so that we could automate the process of figuring out the when. And then based on when a protest happened, we could start to narrow down where it was and so on.
Yeah, I think one thing that leaps out when you start to look into some of C2's investigations and the cases they've been involved in are a lot of superlatives or firsts. So for example, in the Intercept reported that this latest settlement is the largest protester settlement ever for abuses committed by at least U.S. police or perhaps the NYPD. There was a case in Timbuktu that went to the ICC, and it was resulted in the first person tried for the destruction of cultural heritage and also the first to plead guilty before the tribunal. That was reported in Wired. So I do want to address later on, you know, some of the limitations and caveat by saying that these technologies are not a panacea. But first, I want to talk about, you know, why you think the use of visual investigations and recreations are so compelling and do result in some landmark settlements or verdicts. Why are these new technologies seemingly so effective?
Well, I think there's two ways I would address that. One is that the documentation of these violations is often happening in visual registers, you know, increasingly so, right? Whether that's user-generated content or citizen video, or it's body cam footage, or it's surveillance footage, it's visual in nature. And so, as I mentioned before, you know, it's rarely ever one video that tells the whole story. You know, it's usually a combination of different videos that get you closer to understanding the facts of an event. And I think for that reason, these tools are proving themselves very effective. You know, in the case in Mali for the International Criminal Court, it was very helpful to see, for example, you know, this was a destruction of cultural heritage case. So what did the shrines look like before they were destroyed? There was actually documentation of them being destroyed, like in the process of being destroyed. And then what did they look like after destruction? And this, you know, documentation existed for, I think, 13 shrines around the city of Timbuktu. So, you know, it would be one thing to look at all of that material in isolation, but to be able to put it together in a platform and for the attorneys to be able to kind of move around the city and take the judges and the defense through an argument, I think was very effective in that case. Similarly, with the work on suppression of dissent, I think there's often a narrative, irrespective of where in the world you're doing this work, that protests, civil unrest, is the situations just get too complicated. You know, they're just too complex to understand. You know, it's too chaotic. That is a very convenient narrative for people who are not interested in accountability. I think what we're trying to demonstrate, and hopefully what some of this recent work shows, is that they are complicated events, even chaotic, but through careful analysis and visual analysis, you can often create a baseline understanding of a use of force, for example, or what led up to the moments that the use of force occurred. It takes the sort of complexity, it takes the "it's too complex" narrative off the table and creates a point of entry for beginning to try and answer certain questions. That's proven to be useful in a number of different cases recently.
I'm also curious about the scale of resources needed to create something like the digital platform in the Mali case, for example. Are these expensive technologies? Do they require a lot of manpower? And how might it compare, perhaps, I don't know, to armies of associates trying to conduct similar research or present similar evidence without the aid of visual technologies, for example?
I mean, it's certainly a lot of labor and it takes time. But I think what's salient here is that the profile of who's doing the work is changing a bit, I would say, in terms of investigations. I mean, the people working on the Mali case have computer science backgrounds and design backgrounds, which are not necessarily traditional forensic certification or investigative, you know, backgrounds. And that's a whole other thing we can talk about, which is this question of expertise and how to square that with, you know, providing testimony and being a witness, et cetera. But people coming out of architecture schools, out of film schools, out of CS programs, they have skill sets that are proving to be very, very useful for the direction a lot of this work is going. And I think it's changing a bit the kind of landscape in who's being hired to work in newsrooms and advocacy organizations and even in legal contexts. So I think, yes, it's a lot of work, it takes time, but it's not that the software or the tools are, you know, out of reach. The bar is so high in terms of cost. It's more about understanding that the people doing the work and that their training and skill sets that they're bringing are perhaps a bit different than the traditional ones.
And in addition to maybe the resource question and sifting through immense amounts of evidence, what other challenges do you face when embarking on a visual investigation? or have historically faced. I'm thinking perhaps, you know, with these new types of people and new new backgrounds coming into the criminal justice or international justice space, perhaps a reticence to accept new technologies in the courtroom. So I don't know, just kind of a more broad question of the kinds of challenges that you face and have faced over the past number of years that you've been engaged in this work.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And I, each of these domains that we're sort of moving between law and advocacy and journalism, they function at different speeds. I would say journalism being usually the fastest, right? And maybe law at the other end of the spectrum. I think in the beginning, you know, there was reticence to introducing new tools and technologies and new forms of expertise within the legal domain, particularly at the ICC. And I'm talking like 10 years ago before we even started work there, because it was very much an unknown, and it's a tough place to experiment. You know, the cost of failure is very high, and you can do a lot of damage. And I think that there was an appropriate level of, you know, it's appropriately conservative in terms of approaching, you know, new tools and methods. And so I would say that the ambitions were tempered in the first case we did with the ICC. Let's not try and do everything we can do. Let's just make a platform where we can better present images, photographs, satellite images, 360 panoramic images, you know, basically just presentation. And so we did that. It was, I think, by all accounts, effective. Everyone kind of agreed on its effectiveness at the end, and that set a precedent. And as we know in law, precedent is a big deal. And that meant that the next case that we were able to work on, which is the Al Hassan case, was a lot more ambitious in terms of what we sought to do. And so I think it's a more incremental sort of progress in legal contexts in which we've worked. But as we set precedent and demonstrate the utility and the ability to kind of stand behind the work and talk about how it's made, there's more and more appetite and willingness, I'd say, to do new things. In the journalistic realm at the other end of the spectrum, I think it's super interesting to see how, like, the visual investigations team at the New York Times, for example, is just doing, you know, remarkable work time and again on really urgent global questions, right, and cases. And I think that is, those two things are kind of pulling at opposite ends of the sort of same question.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report,
They informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
And just to get the listeners up to speed, could you walk us through the Al-Hassan case, also in Mali, but distinct, I believe, from the cultural heritage case that C2 also worked on?
Yeah, it was distinct also in Mali, but it was Al-Hassan was the de facto head of the Islamic police, alleged head of the Islamic police in 2012 and 2013, and he's on trial at the moment. The verdict should be issued soon, and being charged with a host of different things, gender-based violence, in addition to destruction of cultural heritage. The ask was very different of us in this case from the first one. In this case, it was a more ambitious, there's a bigger appetite to do something more ambitious this time, but it was basically, could we build a model or a digital twin of the city of Timbuktu? And because the prosecution was looking at alleged crimes that were committed across the city on different days, they wanted the ability to kind of move through the urban environment virtually and then pull up important evidentiary assets as they related to, let's say, the headquarters of the Islamic police, which was housed in a bank building, or, you know, photographs of Sharia law being carried out in an open square or something like this in a different part of the city. And so the underlying evidence was photographs and videos, and but to be able to place them in space and to be able to understand them in relation to each other geographically and temporally, once again, time and space is kind of fundamental here, and to move around the city was the mandate. So we were asked to build this digital model and then to place the evidence of these key sites within that digital model, and to do it in an interactive format. And I think this is an important and interesting detail. But basically, by interactive, I mean you can query it, you know, you can click on different parts of the city, you can click on the names of different parts of the city or the map, and then you can pull up information as you like. It's not a linear work product like a video would be, for example. And I think that's important because we can provide it without over-determining how it will be used in court. It might be used by the prosecution in one way, the judges might use the tool in a different way, and the defense, you know, differently still. So that's how it was used. It was used to present the case. And as I said, the arguments have been closed and they're waiting on a verdict.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to raise. I think there can be a misconception that this is just a tool for the prosecution, for example, in proving that a certain crime or abuse was committed. And I also brought up the Al-Hassan case because Alice Spiri, in her article in The Intercept, recent article talking about the Al-Hassan case, she cited an email that Al-Hassan's defense team had submitted to the court in which they describe this seeing is believing tendency. So they write in the email that there's research that says that there's an undue reliance that the viewer may place on the evidence presented through a visualization medium that's often reserved to seeing is believing. So I want to use that as a way to open up some of the thornier ethical, legal, and other questions that these new technologies raise. So first, I'm curious your thoughts on this "quote unquote seeing is believing" tendency, and then you know maybe other ethical or legal issues that have come up for you.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really good point. The work is definitely seductive visually, and I think we need to be very aware and responsible for that reality. I mean, on the one hand, it is, you know, very compelling visually and seductive in that way. On the other hand, the underlying assets are visual. So for me, the answer to the question is increased visual literacy, I would say, all around for the judges, you know, to get used to using and sort of looking at evidence in this way, for the defense, for the prosecution. I think there is a threshold we cross potentially when using tools with witnesses, especially, you know, the potential to re-traumatize witnesses. You know, some of the work in this field is moving into VR, virtual reality, and augmented reality, which is a very powerful, immersive way to kind of be present, right, in a space, or to be virtually present in a space. But it's led to some interesting conversations, and really valid conversations, about not inadvertently re-traumatizing witnesses or, you know, victims that have been through really awful events, and bringing them back to that moment in time. So I think, you know, the power of the tools is very clear, and it is clear that they can be, you know, strong and evocative, and need to be wielded responsibly. But I do disagree with the argument that they should be de facto sort of, you know, not allowed to be used because they're too convincing. I think if the underlying evidence is visual evidence, we should be able to find a way to present it and synthesize it so that we can do the best job at kind of getting to the facts, right? I think the way to address some of this transition in a moment where people are kind of moving from what has been dominated by text to things which are, you know, maybe more evenly distributed by text, between text and visual information, is, like I said, increased literacy and comfort and criticality. You know, we need to give people the tools to be critical of these, of the visual formats in which things are being presented. And I do think, you know, in the ICC's case, we were working with the Office of the Prosecutor, but I'm very keen to also work with the defense and to make sure that people feel like they have, you know, equal access to these tools, and it's not an arms race in terms of, you know, who can afford to employ them in proceedings. That remains important to us, and something which I think needs to be leveled out.
Yeah, they're great points. And given some of these concerns you raised in terms of re-traumatizing victims, or perhaps a lack of visual literacy, sometimes on the receiving end, are there any more best practices or principles that guide your work? I'm thinking not just for C2 research, but also across the community, maybe even broader in the open source intelligence community. Thinking specifically maybe of the recent Berkeley protocol that was developed. But do you see a sort of standardization happening across, you know, C2 and the wider community that does similar work?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there's two things that are happening that have been very helpful for us, and I think for others in this community. I mean, certainly the Berkeley Protocol provided a kind of a standardization of some of the best practices for verifying user-generated content and open source information. And, you know, certainly I'm sure it can be improved, and there might be a 2.0 or a 3.0 version of it, but just having a baseline that, you know, we can agree upon as the best practice is already massively helpful, so that not everybody is doing it a different way. And I think that it introduces a degree of sort of formalization in a field that's been a little bit like the Wild West, which I think is definitely been a positive, it's had a positive effect, and is also giving people points of entry into, like, you know, new lines of work. You know, there's a whole population of people who would like, you know, who are doing this work more informally and on their own time, but, you know, would like to do it professionally. And things like the Berkeley Protocol, I think, provide a structure and point of entry for how these skill sets can be applied. Again, whether it's a newsroom or it's an advocacy organization or you're working at a court. So I think that's things like that are very useful. But I do see them as living documents. In other words, like, to be revisited and updated, because it needs to be recognized that it's a nascent field. The other, which is a very big deal and not limited to visual investigations, is vicarious trauma. Being intentional about the amount of exposure people doing this line of work have with violent content, repeated exposure. I mean, the content moderators at YouTube, for example, you know, that's an example of an adjacent field where you have a lot of the same issues, right? And there's been important work done by a few different folks, Sam Dubberly, who's now at Human Rights Watch, and the folks at Berkeley as well, on how to, you know, minimize harm for those who are, you know, viewing this footage over and over and over again, and in preparation for its use again in these different contexts. And I think that's best practices around that, and even, you know, destigmatizing some of this experience and opening it up to making it okay to talk about it with your colleagues, and that it's difficult to watch sometimes, has made this work, I think, more doable and healthier in a certain way.
I want to briefly go back to one thing you mentioned about this seduction of the visual media or the medium that you're using. One thing I certainly noticed, I think anyone will notice when they're first experiencing these visual investigations by C2, by Forensic Architecture, even the mainstream outlets like the New York Times, who have visual investigations teams, is that many of them are quite visually striking and even beautiful, mm-hmm. even if they are depicting really heinous things. So I would love to hear a bit more of your thoughts on how aesthetics plays a role, and, you know, almost a beautiful presentation, very, you know, sort of clean models and diagrams, how aesthetics play a role essentially.
Yeah, no, it's a important question. And I think it's something we think about a lot. I mean, for us, it's about maintaining clarity about who the work is for and why we're doing it. In other words, our goal is not to make anything beautiful. It's to make something clear. The byproduct might be that it is aesthetically pleasing or beautiful or seductive, but it's just that. It's a byproduct and not the intention. And I think it can be problematic when, you know, work has multiple destinations. You know, for example, it's going to be in court, but it's also going to be used in an exhibition at a museum. Like, it is true that the people doing the work, you know, may come from visual arts backgrounds, or they may come from filmmaking, and, you know, their entire education was around aesthetic questions. So I don't think you can remove that completely from the equation. But I think for us, it's remaining absolutely clear on the destination being, you know, not the museum as a first destination, or not the exhibition, or not some place where the kind of aesthetic questions are foregrounded, but rather the courtroom, and in the service of addressing the facts of the case in that context. And that may mean, you know, for example, getting extremely familiar with the IT setup in a given courtroom, which sounds very technical and sort of banal, but has everything to do with what something looks like at the end of the day, because, you know, different courtrooms in different jurisdictions, some might have monitors at every desk, some might have one monitor on the, you know, 100 feet away. We need to understand those constraints in terms of the ability to perceive and convey information clearly so that we can create something that can be read and understood in those contexts effectively. It's not to say that things, you know, these do absolutely have aesthetic qualities. I'm not saying that they don't. And they do. I think it is actually very interesting and generative when these work products end up in very different contexts, like perhaps in a museum or in a film or something like this. But that's always for us a second destination and not the first. And it's important to keep those priorities in mind. But I think the conversations that happen at those second destinations are very interesting to track and be part of, because the perspectives are radically different in a room of artists and philosophers than they would be for a team of lawyers and human rights practitioners.
Yeah, I should say that the first thing I think that struck me is, you know, just how visually stunning some of these things are, or striking. And the second thing is, I think what you've touched on many times in this conversation is just how, I think, by necessity, multidisciplinary it is. I want to, though, turn to some of the limitations of this technology, these technologies, these investigations. We've spoken about some of the remarkable things that visual investigations can accomplish and are, you know, poised to perhaps accelerate, as you spoke about at the top of the conversation, with you know, rapid advancements in machine learning and AI. But what are the current limitations, you know, either in the courtroom? You mentioned, you know, IT setups in certain courtrooms with these sort of banal roadblocks that you may hit. But also, you know, even in a connected world, there are areas of blackouts. So, you know, if a crime occurs somewhere with no smartphones, no satellite imagery, how do you address those kinds of challenges and limitations?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the first question that we need to ask ourselves, which is, you know, there may be an investigative priority, there may be an event of interest, but the first question is like, what are the assets and what does the documentation look like? And you're right. I mean, sometimes it's in a very documentation poor or sparse environment, and there's very little that can be done. And we often are turning away work because we just can't provide anything useful. So it's none of this is a panacea, will change that basic fact, which is that, you know, the data needs to be there to work with in order to actually spend time with it and to see if it's going to be useful. I think one thing that I'm tracking right now, which I think is going to be interesting and scary, is the role of generative AI in our understanding of the representations of the world around us. It is tremendously powerful tool, as we all know, in many different ways, but one of those ways is in describing, you know, cities, for example, 3D environments. And until recently, I think we had a pretty good handle on the various ways in which you can capture information in urban environments. What is going to be important to track is the inflection point between existing modes of capture and the way, you know, large language models can fill in the gaps, so to speak, because you can always work backwards and sort of understand, okay, this was captured using a laser scan, or this was captured using photogrammetry or a photograph. But once you get into the realm of sort of filling in the areas that have not yet been captured using, you know, understood equipment, then you're in the realm of training sets. And it strikes me as very slippery area, and one in which all of us who are interested in sort of fact-finding reporting are going to have to keep a very close eye on. And I think it also, not only is it going to be important to kind of understand where that line exists, but also it provides a lot of, my other fear is that it provides a lot of cover and sort of plausible deniability for those who are constantly interested in throwing doubt on the veracity and authenticity of different types of data, whether they're photographs or digital models or, you know, or other things. So I think that's something that I'm keeping an eye on and quite interested in.
You also sit on the technology advisory board for the ICC. And I was recently also reading in Lice Spiri's article about how the ICC's prosecutor's office launched a very ambitious sort of technical modernization initiative, including a new evidence management platform. So I guess all this is to say, what else are you keeping an eye on? Where do you see, how do you see this field evolving, the use of these tools in the courtroom or outside, you know, in other, I guess, more straightforward journalistic senses?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a organizational model that I'm quite interested in, which is to say, like at the beginning, we talked about how journalism often moves very fast, right? It's a blistering pace of the news cycle, and law often at the other end of the spectrum, slower. I think the nature of this work requires a high degree of agility, and it's highly interdisciplinary work. So no one project is going to look like any other project. Things are always changing. And you have to be comfortable with that level of agility and speed to some extent. So I guess I'm interested in places like the ICC or large human rights organizations. How are large organizations with large bureaucratic structures going to be able to integrate a lot of the tools and more than tools, methods that are constantly evolving? And I think the ICC is doing a version of it there. That Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan is certainly very interested in engaging in a pretty strong way with different types of technologies. But it'll be interesting to see how to marry the ability to be agile and nimble with the realities of both law and bureaucracy. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, watching the visual investigations team at the New York Times, you know, go from 1, 2, 3, and I don't know, maybe there are 20 people now, it's just been amazing. And that when you look at the constitution of that team, it's all different types of skill sets. This is not, they can't be described as a video team. They're not just a graphics team. It's something, you know, really distinct and novel about what's happening there. And it's just taking a different form at the New York Times than it is at the ICC. And, you know, other organizations like Human Rights Watch will have their version of these visual investigations teams. So I think it's sort of coming into its own as a field of practice, and it's looking a little bit different in each of the contexts in which I've been describing. That feels appropriate. The needs are a bit different in each case.
Well, with a lot of things to keep an eye on in the future in this field, which sort of, as you mentioned, in its adolescence, maybe getting past its awkward teenage years, so to speak, I want to thank you very much, Brad Samuels, for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's awkward adolescence is spot on. Yeah, this was an interesting conversation, so thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for other shows, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.